We have a guest speaker tonight. But first, I'm going to talk about me. I've got the microphone. I call myself an old man. People say, oh, you're not that old. Well, technically, they're correct. When both of my parents were around my age, they were dead shortly thereafter, and they were a lot older than I am now at the age of 57. The reason why I gleefully and gladly call myself an old man is because I've lived three or four lifetimes in my time. I came out as a gay man in the 70s. I dove deep into the deepest part of the gay Leatherman scene. I have a large amount of information that is of great use to people nowadays, you might have noticed, and I gladly share it. What we've been needing desperately is to find other, I'm putting quotes around it, elders, people who've been down different paths, people who have wisdom, but far more important, are willing to share it. One of the biggest problems that we have in any culture, in any city in our culture, is you could be at the supermarket, and you could walk past somebody and not know that he's been, you know, the premier king of single-tail whips in San Diego, but he never got around to explaining it to the rest of us, and he only deals with people one-on-one. You walk past him, and the opportunity is lost. Or you drive past somebody's house every damn day on your way to work, and you have no idea that there's a soundproofed sling room in the garage with toys hanging on the wall, and the opportunity is lost. What we need is to find the people who are worth their weight in diamonds and rubies in our community, the people who have the wisdom, but far more important, give a damn about the rest of us enough to teach us and to tell us and to share their stories and to share their wisdom and their experience. And it says a lot about our guest speaker tonight that he is here specifically to share his wisdom with us. And I hope he comes back many, many times. My request of you guys, see, what I promised him is that this is his support team. And I think you guys can back me up on this. That the difference, you came here from San Francisco, isn't that right, Mark?
Yep.
The difference between San Diego and Dallas and Denver and San Francisco and New York and places off in Europe and everything is that if you are somebody with a powerful dream, you're pretty much on your own. Everyone for themselves, it's the law of the jungle. Here in San Diego, we don't have the law of the jungle. Instead, we have massive amounts of support for someone with a powerful dream, someone with a big heart, someone with the soul of a champion. If someone has a big and powerful dream and wants to share it, or if someone has wisdom, there's a huge, huge support system for them. And my request of everyone, whatever feedback you have about tonight, make sure that he hears it. That is the gift that you can give him in return for his kindness tonight. Because the more he understands what it is that people love about him and about what he is sharing, the more likely he's going to come back and be a gift in our lives again. So thank you. I'd like to introduce our guest speaker for tonight, Mark Luchesko. Put this here.
Okay.
Put this here. And just...
All right. Well, thank you, everyone. My name's Mark, and I've been really excited to get to connect tonight. I usually work on Wednesdays, so I haven't been able to come to these meetings, but I wanted to kind of just make a moment where I could and got to change my schedule tonight, and just am happy to be here. I'm really happy something like this exists in San Diego. I moved here a while back, and it's been a hard city to kind of get to learn how to connect with. It's very different terrain. I've been living in San Francisco for 24 years, and before that, outside Philadelphia. So I had a few questions before I start. How long do you usually talk or gather?
Well, we're limited to, we have to leave by 11 p.m.
Okay, how do you normally? Yeah. How long do you normally?
But normally around 8 o'clock or so, we take a 10-minute break, and then we just keep going until everybody gets sick again.
All right, so I don't know how long I'll go. I have a rough idea of what I want to share, but we'll just see how it goes. What I thought is I wanted to ask a few questions first, and then I thought I would tell you just a little bit about the experiences I've had being part of the leather scene, and with a focus on how people have been connecting over the course of my life and how it's changed. And then I actually have an exercise that I wanted to kind of walk everyone through and just learn as much about you and how you're connecting these days. And we'll see how it goes. So first, let me ask a few questions. Raise your hand if you primarily think of yourself as a dominant man. That's a pretty high, actually. It's almost 50%. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how many of you would primarily think of yourself as a submissive man? Okay, actually less. How many of you would think of yourself as primarily a fetishist? Okay. And how many of you just do not put yourself in a category? All right. I've been traveling through all those different areas. You know, I always, the older I get, and I'm 49, when people have asked me to describe the difference between a top and a bottom, or a submissive and a dominant, or master and slave, I usually say that, using the submissive is a guy who really wants to please another man or another group. And a dominant is someone who wants to really please another man. Or another group. in fact, the longer I've been in this scene, the less differences I see between tops and bottoms, masters and slaves. And it's interesting, I'm in a situation right now where I identify myself primarily as a submissive guy. And yet, in my relationship, I'm the dominant to a pup who's also my age. And that's been interesting to work out, and I realize that as a dominant, I'm doing a lot of the same things that I've done most of my life as a submissive. Just as a slightly different flavor, and sometimes when it comes to bondage scenes, I have to figure out how long, you know, Pee-wee's Great Adventure is before I untie someone, so I'll get back to that. The next thing I'm curious about is, how do most of you meet new people? Is it in the bars? Is it online? Is it from other friends? Online?
In this group.
Yeah. In this group. Your experiences, yeah. In this group, okay.
In all three.
All three?
Yeah.
Has it been changing over the course of your time?
It depends on what type of, what do you want, quantity or quality. If you want quantity, get online. If you want quality, find somebody who says, you know, refers you to a person. That's
I disagree. I've got some really great friends that I've met online originally. And the thing is, of course, online is more prevalent now because it's more readily accessible to everybody. But,
okay.
Since he's not walking up here, please speak way up.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Well, also, one additional factor that makes us a little unusual is that by creating a local tribe, it greatly increases people's likelihood that whoever they're going to talk to is actually a really nice person, which mm-hmm. takes away a lot of the guessing. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot more trustworthiness in whatever new face you run into with this group.
When it's in person? Yeah. When it's in the group, yes. Okay.
And there's the bar is still, in Palm Springs especially, I'm there on the weekends, live there part-time, so I meet nice people, have a connection there, and new people, so.
Uh-huh.
I think for me, I'm the closest I've ever gotten to leather and fetish was walking by the Eagle up until tonight. So in general, meeting gay men, whether for hookups or friends or whatever it is, I think in today's day and age, it's gone to online. I think that's prevalent in the way that we meet other people. And I think I'm going to agree with Tommy. I think with quality, it would come from a setting like this. Mm-hmm. Whether it's play or whether it's just for friends or wherever we're going, the quality really kind of comes from community. Mm-hmm. And then meeting in bars, but I haven't gotten out in San Diego. I think I've been more into the gay boy scene since I've been in San Diego than ever before. But I think the most that I've met was online, and it generally doesn't go any further than just chit-chatting online because I kind of fear to venture any further.
Okay.
So, that's me. That's my sense. I
Because sometimes at events like mine, year after year, you meet friends, and that it doesn't happen always the first time, but you see them the next year and the next year. And you actually become friends, and you stay at their house, and you call.
It's a big class reunion in some way, yes. Yeah. Well, let me go back and tell you a little bit about how I've been meeting people over the course of time. When I was a teenager, I used to watch a lot of movies where there was people getting kidnapped and things like that. And they always really compelled me because the thing that I always thought about the people who were getting kidnapped and tied up was that they got kind of taken care of in the process, you know. They were the center of attention, they were being bargained for, they were being fed, you know. And so very early on, and I mean like 12 and 13, I started telling myself a lot of stories about getting kidnapped. And I became really fascinated with being tied up. I remember the first book I ever shoplifted from my mother's hair salon was this Hardy Boys book called While the Clock Ticked. And the reason I had to have it was because the Hardy Boys were tied up. On the front cover. And at home, I started tying myself up. I didn't quite know what I was doing, but I just really liked it. I always felt really safe, and I always fantasized better. And very early on, I was kind of bringing bondage together with masturbating. In fact, I got my parents to get me a chin-up bar. And the very first time I actually came was hanging upside down while I was, had handcuffed my ankles to the chin-up bar. I got even more precarious. I started, I also skipped school a lot. And I would take the train down to Philadelphia and I would buy porn magazines. The very first time I went there, the woman behind the register at the gay bookstore wouldn't sell them to me, and I asked to see the manager, because I was very precocious, and we spent 3 hours having ice cream, and he came back and he said, sell that kid some porn. So I was reading Drummer magazine when I was 16, and I remember reading it, and the thing that fascinated me about it was there was this crazy world over on the West Coast and in New York. That was just, I couldn't describe what kind of fantasies it was. Like, and Drummer was really good at spinning a really good, you know, idea of leather culture. And I remember thinking, even as a young kid, this can't last. Nothing this crazy or, you know, buoyant, so to speak, can last. And the way that people would connect is through these Drummer ads, and you would, you know, it would be mostly through getting a Polaroid, unless you were brave enough to take your photographs to get actually developed. Because don't think that teenager at your pharmacy wasn't looking through your pictures. So I remember I got my parents to get me a Polaroid camera. And you would send away, you know, you'd write a letter to the box office, or oftentimes it was to Drummer itself, and then they would forward it to the person who actually had the thing. So it could be easily 3 weeks or a month before you got any word back from someone. And even then, it was just your first letter. And so literally 3 months might go before you actually start trusting someone or anything like that. I was very good at skipping school, so I would go down and take the train to Philadelphia, where I also went to the gay center and to this youth coming out group, where I was this little suburban kid, terrified, and there were a lot of really street-smart kids around me who were already hustling, and oh, my God, I was terrified. I also got picked up the very first time I went outside the gay center. Well, after I had vanilla sex for the very first time, the very second time I wanted to have SM sex. I was like, got that vanilla stuff out of the way. because I already had all these incredibly vivid ideas of kinky sex from these Drummer magazines. There's Larry, I don't know if Larry Townsend still sells, but he was a vendor of leather porn, and I also would get to the mailbox before my parents did, and I started sending away for porn in the mail to my parents' house.
Oh my God.
So I got this book by Larry Townsend called The RFM's Book of Bondage, and I still have it to this day, and it's still one of the most erotic things that I can think of. And I thought that all the men in those pictures were so brave because I knew that they had left the life they lived to kind of cross over into this very radical world, you know, and because they were doing incredibly radical things in these pictures and they were putting them out there. I mean, these people could have been blackmailed for what it's worth. You could easily lose your job back in 1979 or whatever this was. Knowing that I had to I basically answered an ad for these two leather guys in Queens Village, Philadelphia, from the Philadelphia Gay News. And I took the train and I met them. And I remember they made me took out my earring because it was on the left side, and that was for a top. And they were trying to do a humiliation scene with me, and they asked me to vacuum their house naked, and I didn't really think. I just thought that they wanted me to tidy up before sex. And so I started vacuuming just like it was nothing. And they were like, you can stop now. just stop. And I was like, oh, okay. They tied me up, we had sex, and it was incredibly clumsy, and I couldn't get hard, and I thought I disappointed them, and it was the most exciting thing I'd ever done in my life. And I was hooked. You know, the only thing for many years I wanted to do was be some daddy's boy. You know, finding a daddy was, I was all out bent to find that man. So fast forward a little bit, I came out to my parents. They didn't like that so much. It became really difficult to live with them. They wanted me to put me through shock therapy. And so I moved out. And I had a girlfriend at the time who I hadn't come out to, and her family took me in. So I lived with them. And so I was very lucky because I have two families, and I actually know them all to this day. And they're just wonderful. I have two... two sets of parents. One, my father's passed away now, but... So I get off to college, and I'm in Philadelphia, and what I would do is I would take the train 3 hours up to Philadelphia for a one-hour gay men's SMS activist meeting and take another train 3 hours back. Because I just wanted to meet these people, and I didn't know anywhere in Philadelphia where they were meeting. And the New York group was a pretty serious group. They had been around since the early 70s, and they truly were a trip. They were amazing guys. Once again, they were brave. You know, they were living the dream that they wanted to. And, you know, being gay was one thing, you know, in the late 70s and early 80s, but being gay and queer and into SM was pretty, you had to have balls, to say the least. And these were, they really relied on each other, and they really took me in. Because I was about 15 years younger than anyone else in the group at the time, but they taught me a lot. And I remember I started meeting people in a whole new way. I remember very early on I agreed to be one of their demos where I thought they were going to tie me up and just shave my crotch. And so this guy tied me up in front of all these guys at what was the Hellfire Club. And he proceeded to then shave my head. And I hadn't expected that. Where I was turned down and terrified. And once again, shaving your head in 1980 wasn't really the norm. And I remember coming back and I had a job. And I was so terrified to come into work with a shaved head. I was also beating off so often because I was looking at myself with a shaved head because it was just so amazing. It was an amazing experience. I remember they poured beer all over me. I crawled through the crowd. It was just, I loved it. I was like, this is it. And I was very much into humiliation. That was very much a mental charge for me. So fast forward a little bit. I'm in school. I'm part of the gay group at college, and I remember I asked my family doctor to give me a nipple piercing. And he did with one of the ear piercing things, so it like was at the very edge of my nipple, ready to be teared out at any moment. But because I had a nipple piercing, the gay group, the guys all called me Mr. Leatherman. And none of them really did it, and so I was kind of out, and But this one kid in the military sought me out, and he was my first boyfriend. And I remember I thought I was really suave because I thought that if you drank alcohol, you know, you'd be really... So I had port wine, like a good... with a whole little thing, chandelier, you know, glass. And I had him over to my house, and I asked him, I said, so are you vanilla? That was, you know, I was trying to see what he wanted to do. And he looked at me, and I think he was 18 or even 17 because he might have gotten into college earlier. And he goes, I'm chocolate. And then I said, well, what religion are you? And he goes, I'm Catholic. And I said, oh, that'll do. And I, you know, told him that I really was into, you know, I wanted to do kinky things. And he was all into that the very first time we did it. And then he wouldn't talk to me for 4 months. I tried to tie him up, and he wouldn't talk to me until one night he came over to... I actually had gotten my first studio apartment, and he came over, and he started coming over really drunk, and he would buzz the bell, and he would say, yeah, I just want to come up, and I just want to try on your chaps. And I'd be like, okay, and he would come up, and he would try on my chaps and get all freaked out and then leave. And because this was really intense stuff. You know, there wasn't any images. There wasn't any Tumblr. There wasn't anything saying that this was okay. And he already was having a hard time coming out at all. And but eventually, you know, he started calming down, and we were together for 5 years. it's funny because I remember the next year during Halloween, he wanted to go out with a collar on and a chain. And I usually bought them to him, and he used to tie me up because he was more comfortable that. And I couldn't conceive of like topping or anything at the time. But I remember that night, I put a collar on him and chain. He dragged me all around Philadelphia, and so it was my first lesson of what it's like to be a top sometime. So we were together. We explored Philadelphia a lot, New York, and after college, we had thought we had just done all of Philadelphia and all of New York, and so we started looking at other towns. And he made this little list of requirements, like good transit and, you know, sunny days. And I made one. I said, number of leather bars. And that was my only requirement. And San Francisco came up on our list of places to go. And I looked at him and I said, I am not moving to that hippie town. No way. That was my idea of it. And we went, during Folsom. And we went during what was called the Mr. Drummer Contest. And... I've been to 25 Folsoms now, so it's been interesting to see that change. Back then, Dury Alley up in San Francisco was a really small fair. It was only one block long, and Folsom was maybe three blocks. We went, and we were drummer boys, and we fell in love with some of the contestants, and... I'll backtrack a little bit. When we would go to New York, there was a store called The Noose, and I was starting to begin to buy things and stuff like that. And one time I went there, and I only had $40, and I wanted to buy something so badly, no matter what it was. And they had a sale, and they had a rubber shirt for $40, and I had no idea what I was getting into. I just bought it because it was $40. And I tried it on, and I instantly loved it. And very early on, I started developing a rubber fetish, which already made me feel different. So here I was in a bunch of people who were already different, but they all wore leather, and I wanted to wear rubber, and a lot of guys were really uncomfortable when you would wear rubber. They would say it was really feminine. And yet I knew that guys in Europe wore it, so that was the only thing that kind of kept me going wearing rubber. Years later, for Folsom, I had one of the first rubber aprons made at Mr. S, and because I'm really short... I would be in pictures with all my tall friends with the apron kind of tucked around me, and it was cut off the bottom, and all my friends asked me why I wore a little black dress to Folsom that year. We get to San Francisco, and I just didn't understand San Francisco. The streets were huge. There were wires overhead. It was gorgeous, but it was just weird. for me, and I was really nervous about it, but Folsom was amazing. Walking around in my rubber shirt at Folsom and out in the street, and there were naked people, and there were obviously lots of leather men. We instantly fell in love, and 3 weeks later, we moved there. And I expected to be there about a year or two, and I ended up living there 24 years. During that time, a lot changed. About 2 months after I had sex for the first time, there was an article on GRID.
Yeah.
And
gay-related immunodeficiency.
Right. So that was what AIDS was called first. And I it's funny because I remember looking at those porn magazines and thinking, oh yeah, there was no way that was going to last. There had to be something coming down. And when I remember reading about it, I was like, oh, okay. And I was terrified. I was terrified of getting sick. And that really pushed me to being a kinky person more, because I was really comfortable getting tied up. And I was I was more comfortable with the fact that there were rules and you kind of could figuring out, and I was told what to do, and I wasn't being put in these kind of just, I don't know, situations where I didn't know what was going on. It was very structured, and I liked that. It made me feel safer. And so if I wasn't going to become kinky, AIDS really pushed me to actually get kinkier, because it was easier to have safe sex, which was ironic, because if you looked at all the safe sex guides, they would usually say fisting and all these things as like the most unsafe activity, and it was the most safe activity. And I think largely survived a really difficult period because I was sexually active but in this kind of structured way. I get to San Francisco, and it was really crazy because people were dying left and right around us. One of my best friends was in the military. He was 21. He was caught being fisted by his commanding sergeant, and he was the one who was kicked out of the military. He died about 6 months later because he had salmonella poisoning. He had eaten an egg. I remember he had to be fed by a port in his chest. And by this time I had started, the earthquake happened and I lost my job. I was going to work at Drummer actually, which was going to be a real fantasy. And I started selling poppers at the Eagle, and I didn't know what poppers were. And I didn't know why people wanted them. And I didn't know why they were paying so much money for a little bottle that I thought stunk like sneakers. That gave me a headache. The guy who owned Mr. S. Leather, who owned this little store in the Eagle, asked me if I understood how to run computers. And so I came and I said, yeah, I know how to use computers. I had a Mac, one of the first Macs, with a little disk, 400K, that had the operating system, the programs, and your documents on it that took 10 minutes to load. And I thought it was the coolest thing in the world. I made the first inventory system for Mr. S. Leather. The original owner still, he was a wonderful man from England called Alan Selby, and he was a remarkable businessman because he would sell things at less than he purchased them for. So once we had a computer system and we found out how much it cost to sell shower shop, a metal bidet, we found out that he was selling them for about 3/4 of what he had bought them for. So it was kind of interesting. I helped them make their first few catalogs, which were paste up material. We pasted the pictures on. I started to get a lot more involved. San Francisco had a big leather culture. I met my first daddy, my boyfriend and I broke up, but we were still friends. He would come to Mr. S. I remember thinking that Mr. S. was going to be so awesome. I was going to wear like chaps all day and rubber all day. And when you're the admin guy who sits at a computer all day, the chaps isn't as sexy after a while. But it was really an intense time for me. I just thought I was living this life that I had always wanted to live. I got to understand the leather title culture. We had a guy come in who had won International Mr. Black Pendulum, which was a black bar in town. And he was really upset when we abbreviated the words on his leather sash because we couldn't figure out how to put all those words in the space. And so for one gay day, I had a leather sash made for me, and it just read "No one in particular."
You said "Read what?"
No one in particular.
Oh.
So I was really beginning to get out there. I'd go out to the Castro in full rubber. I mean, I was just doing it. I was just so happy. And then I got hepatitis. And I got so sick that I laid in a room, pretty much empty, sick. I had never been that kind of sick. And so I got sent back to my second family, and they took care of me. And I suddenly began to realize what it was like for people who were getting sick of AIDS. How the carpet was really pulled from underneath them. And it was scary. I had never really occurred to me what was going on. I was scared of it, but I didn't really have an idea what was going on. So when I went back to San Francisco, I was just a little bit more reluctant. I met a guy who was in the back of Drummer magazine, who talked about how he was really into humiliation, and he became my next sir. And we explored a lot. He was really big into cutting and piercing, and a real intellect, and it was really amazing to kind of have an even more serious kind of leather relationship. I then went through a few other... met up my first vanilla relationship, where he used to laugh at me for being into kink, but I was so in love with him. And when that broke up, I was really devastated. It was the first time I had really fallen in love, and in a way that I had never felt before. And so about a month after that, it was Folsom again, and this really young kid who was Arab caught my eye, and we were in an AOL chat room. And he asked me to come over, and I did, and he tied me up, and he booty bumped me with Crystal for the first time, and I didn't realize what it was. I had the first time I ever had unfettered sex. It was just, I'm really uptight guy, I'm anxious, there's a huge oak pole up my ass, and this was amazing, and I didn't know what was going on, and I just wanted more, and, he would do it every time, and, it was about a month before I realized that every time we had sex, we had this ritual of shoving liquid up my ass. And by that time, he was like, "Yeah, that's crystal meth." And I was like, "Really? That's awesome. Let's do more of that." I moved in with him. And I became his live-in slave for a year and a half. I had become a librarian. So by day, I would go off and work at the library. And... In the evenings, I would come home, and I would get undressed. I would get collared. I would, we would do a lot of bondage. I cleaned the house. I didn't make dinner to this day. I'm a, this little sidebar to any of my submissiveness that's not cooking. Unless you want to eat really terrible food. And in fact, during that time, we became very, what I would call, disciplined about the drug use. We did it once a month. It was an extravagant weekend, but we were actually very much in love with each other, and we didn't want the drugs to take over. And when you do drugs, there's this kind of romance period, so to speak, where it doesn't get bad. And for that 2 years, the first 2 years I did meth, it didn't get bad. He was positive, and one of his biggest prides was that he never infected me. He was really a lovely man. In fact, even though we had drugs in our relationship, it was one of the best relationships, and he was one of the best sirs I've ever had, and he was quite young. And I just wanted to live that life even more. But when we broke up, because the drugs did start to get bad, and when I mean start to get bad, I mean we would have fights coming down and do things like spray paint, "I wish you would die" in 8-foot letters in black paint in our studio apartment. It got really awful. And I don't want to make it about drugs, but it became really awful. He was young. Suddenly his youth came out. I didn't know what to do. We broke up for about a year. I would still come over to his house to feed him. I would come over after he had been partying for 4 or 5 days, bring food, pay his electric bill. Sometimes the next day I'd come back to see his face smashed in a hamburger because he had fallen asleep in it. It was really, and I loved this man. So it really flipped me out that I was now taking care of what the guy who had been my master, the guy who had been my dominant, who had taken so much care out of me, who had given me every fantasy I ever wanted to have. And I also was now doing meth regularly. I didn't want to do it with anyone because I was scared of getting sick, so I found a way to score the drugs, and I, for the next 14 years, I did drugs pretty much by myself. Very early on in my second year, I reached out to a group called the Stonewall Group, which was about harm reduction, and I kind of found a way to do it without killing myself, but successively I just kind of went more loopy. My sex got a lot darker. I started finding tops online because now you had sites like Leather Navigator and other kind of more sophisticated leather hookup sites. And I remember talking to people who were going to want to kidnap me and dehumanize me. My rubber fantasies got deeper. I started interacting with a lot of people who did a lot of heavy drugs. And I went to, did some very, very dark things. In periods of that, I would have a year or so where I did very little because someone would come into my life and they would kind of release me from that. But I never quite got sober until 3 years ago. But during that time, I actually was trying to get out and met some really amazing men who took care of me in a new way. My early fantasies had been shattered a little bit about what this idea of escaping into this world of being a slave was like. I found out that no matter how much I tried to escape into that world, the world always kind of came and chased me back. And my father had passed, then I met these two kind of muscle dads. And I had started to explore actual SM versus just fetish and bondage. And they kind of took me in. And it was the first time I was in a threesome. And we formed a family. And it was the first time I really understood kind of the possibilities of what a connection via a leather family could be like. It wasn't about drugs. We had a lot of rituals. A lot of pain rituals where I did my best to please my sirs, and they put me through it, and then they loved me because I was able to do things that were beyond what I thought my capabilities were. We kind of had a skinhead theme going on. We had some pretty violent sex, but I was never more in love ever in all my life. There were difficult times because being part of a threesome can be really complicated. It's not one relationship, it's about 62. There's jealousy. There were times when I got upset seeing my primary sir bottom to his daddy. I got jealous at times. They thought I was kind of a pain in the ass at times, which I was very good at being. But ultimately, it was the first experience I had of being a part of a real family. Then I kind of broke up with them. I had been together with them for about 3 years. My drugs became a little bit very problematic again. And I was in a hotel one night online. Now Recon had come about, and I was on my phone. I was in full rubber with a little piece of skin hanging out so I could be on the phone. And I don't even know why I was there anymore. I wasn't enjoying any of it. And I got online and started talking to these guys who I had been in San Francisco and had always wanted to connect with me. And somewhere in the middle of it, we were talking, you know, all the hot talk that you can online. And at one point I just said, you know, can I call you? And I did. And I just got online and said, you know, I want you to know everything I've been saying to you for the last hour or more has been a lie. I'm high. I'm in a hotel. And I just want you to help me. And one of them was sober, and he said to me, we can help you. I want you to, what was it? There's some program where you would, one of the first geo programs would say where you were. And he goes, I want you to put that on your phone, and I want you to drive over to our house. And I said, great, where's your house? And I said, Palm Springs. And I was like, okay. because I was willing to do anything at that point. I drove high off my ass through a full moon praying the whole time that this was going to be the moment that my life changed. And I get there, I sleep for a little bit, and who is the master of the relationship took me out to a Starbucks, and he goes, I was going to tell you about getting sober, but I suddenly realized that you're way too smart to get sober. You were never going to let someone tell you anything. You were always going to think you know better. So I thought you were going to have a chance, but I don't think you do. And that was exactly what I needed to hear, because I don't like being told I can't do something. And in my life, I've been submissive in a way that if you told me to change myself, I would change myself. If you wanted me to be thin, I lost weight. When the muscle dads wanted me to become incredibly muscular, I added on more muscle than I've ever had in my life. And he wanted me to be sober. So I was like, fine, I'll become sober. And I entered the 12-step program, and I got really embraced by that. And I learned all sorts of amazing things, and I got sober. Since that time 3 years ago, I had one moment where I've relapsed, which I'll tell you about. But I became kind of a slave candidate to them. I understood a little bit more what it was like to be in a threesome. I was living in San Francisco. I came down about every 3 weeks to Palm Springs. And once again, I was so in love. I was so happy. Being a slave for me is a sense of being completely myself. I have a tattoo on my chest that I put in my second year of using drugs called, the very first year when I was a living slave, I had the word slave put on my chest because I had a baby face, and people always kind of wanted to make me their fantasy of a vanilla boy. And I put that on my chest so that when you had to deal with me, you had to deal with that tattoo and deal with what I thought was the real me. When I tried to get sober, I added another layer. So in addition to slave, I wrote one slave, now free. Because I wanted to be sure of the right kind of thing that I was going to enslave myself to, not meth. A lot of masters didn't like seeing that tattoo. They still don't. But my master in Palm Springs, who was sober, understood what it meant. And they were amazing, and they helped me get through one of the most difficult times. It's really hard to be in a long-distance relationship. It's even harder to be in a long-distance relationship that's a three-way. And so ultimately, it was just too much for me. I couldn't bear not being with them. I couldn't bear the period of time that they wanted me to get my shit together, essentially, before I became part of their family. I wanted it to be on, you know, my time. And at some point, I just took my collar off. And then something was really surprising to me is that I still wanted to be sober. I wanted to be sober for me now, not versus for my sir. So that was a real interesting point in my life, because for the first time I was practicing sobriety for myself. I continued to live in San Francisco. I used to be a librarian. During the whole recession, I got kind of laid off, and then for about 3 years couldn't find work. So that was really difficult. But I've stayed sober all except for one night about 13 months ago. I had begun living in cheaper and cheaper places in San Francisco and got mugged by 5 black guys in the Mission. And then had another run-in with a drug dealer who was living next to the house that I was living into and was just freaking out. And I did drugs again. So since I've been in San Diego, I've been slowly becoming more involved in the Sober Fellowship. And I've been really intrigued by how you connect with the leather community here. Because when I got here, when I went to the bars, it wasn't like anything like San Francisco. And I was always trying to imprint San Francisco and San Diego. I was always going, well, where's the San Francisco Cafe? And where's the San Francisco intersection, Castro and 18th? And where's the San Francisco bar? And where are all those people online that are in San Francisco? And it wasn't here. And I got really angry. And I was just like, ugh, God damn this town. I was very unhappy with it because I couldn't decide what it was. You know, I wanted it to be something it wasn't. And then I started getting online and recon. And since it's 8, that might be a good juncture. Do you want to take a break?
Oh, yeah, so I don't remember where you left off. Because I'm dying to hear it. Yeah, we're all really happy, am I right? Yeah.
So this is a good segue, because now, and I wanted to talk just a little bit today about how to connect up in what has been a very different community that, that I've seen over the course of my life. So if you want to take that break, and then...
one question is, when you came out to your parents at a young age, did you came out as gay, and did you come out as a kinky guy?
No, you know, I...
Well,
you know, it's when I read... So I was a little precocious, and my mother was going to college, and so I had read her college textbooks and her psychology textbook, and in it, it said, gay is cool. So I got on the honor roll, and I went, I got in the honor roll, and I'm gay.
And
I thought I was going to have a different reaction. But my second family actually learned that I was kinky. I had gotten a Prince Albert by that time. And I was in the kitchen once, and the sister of my second mom wanted to know why the sun kept reflecting between my robe. And so I told them that about Prince Albert's. And they were very open-minded. They were very...
This is after your piercing?
Yes, after my... Yeah, I had a daddy for a summer in Pensacola, outside of Philadelphia, and he sent away for the needle, and he pierced my, he gave me a PA.
Nice.
So.
Okay, so let's hold the questions until later for now.
So, yeah, I want to, if you have questions. Yes. Oh, sure. Sorry.
I'm a really good blind door.
So, well, so here's the thing that actually prompted me to, you know, for a long time I've been saying I've got to, like, change my schedule on Wednesdays and come to a meeting and all that, but this is what actually made me think that I wanted to really connect with all of you and actually ask my own questions, because since I've been down here in San Diego, I don't drink. Interestingly enough, for being such an addict, I've never drunk. I somehow don't process alcohol, and I've never had that nice, fun, drunk part. I just get sick to my stomach immediately. So that, not making a lot of money, I just never drank. And so I'd go out to the bars oftentimes, and I would just stand there, you know, and everyone got drunker. I just got more confused at what they were talking about. So I would never really, and I've always been too shy a lot of times for the bars, too. It's not really been something I do very much. So even when I came down here, it wasn't really part of my DNA to go out to the bars. I'd become very comfortable being online, and Recon as a site has been around for a long time. But when I got down here, I talked to a lot of guys. I even talked to a lot of guys who say they were doms, but every time it came to the point of meeting, none of them showed up. I mean, we're talking like 20 people here. Then I also had an experience where this young guy, not surprisingly, I try to reach out to the guys who are into rubber, and this one guy who was probably about 22, profoundly identified himself as a rubber slave, talked to me and said that... you know, I was talking to him, and I said, "So, what do you want to have? What do you want to experience?" He goes, "I want you to feed me poppers and fist me." And I said, "Well, why do you call yourself a rubber slave? Why don't you just call yourself a fisting bottom?" He goes, "No, I'm a slave. I am a rubber slave." And we went around and around and around. And I said, "Well, what do you do for your sir?" He goes, "Well, I want you to fist me and feed me poppers." And it was just like I was asking him to do some kind of math that he did not understand, because in his mind there was no he didn't really have any problem with calling himself a rubber slave and then pretty much saying, "I want you to do this to me and I'm not really going to do much back." And in fact, when he found out that I was HIV positive, he didn't want me to even kiss him or touch him. Needless to say, that didn't fly. But it was interesting to me, because I thought to myself, wow, there's so many people who can get on the internet and they can read all these things, And they have all this information, and they have absolutely no understanding of what it is they're reading. And in fact, that when he would tell me how lonely he was, I used to think, well, that makes sense. That's the only thing that's made sense so far. And I felt really sad for him. And I remembered when I was feeling so different from everyone around me, and I mean even different in the kink culture because I was into rubber, when back in the early 80s that was not a predominant fetish yet. I remember feeling like I was a perv among pervs and still feeling very separate from everyone. And I just remember how lonely that was and how lonely I can get. And I thought to myself that I wish someone could show him how to connect online. And so that's actually the other part of what I was going to talk about tonight, which was going to just ask. That's why I started off asking about how you all connect. So a little bit, just to finish the story, right about a month before I moved down here, I'm a submissive guy who identifies himself as a pup, saw me wearing big boots at a sobriety. Someone had turned another year, I think 8 years sober, and kind of asked me out. And so we got together, and all the times I got together, I topped him. And topping is still very new to me. I, in all honesty, have only gotten a hard-on in sobriety. Most of my life, I used to be so scared during sex I couldn't get it up, and then I used to love meth because no one got it up. So, once again, I wasn't different, you know. So, in the last 3 years, have been really new for me, and his only experience of me was as a top. And we both got jobs in different cities. He lives in D.C., and at first I didn't know how to have a relationship with him because I primarily think of myself as a bottom, as a sub. I still would love the idea of finding a master to serve. Over time, when I realized how very like we are, because we both just want to make each other happy, that I've learned to become versatile in a new way, and then I really dominate him because I love him very much. And then he wants me to have a full life, and so he is open to me finding a sir, and we have some additional criteria for it. But it's really amazing for me because for the first time in my life, I've stepped out of my comfort zone. And it's scary. And when I was joking about tying some up and then figuring out how long to keep them tied up, and usually I go, we'll do something like watch Pee Wee's Big Adventure. I was, because sometimes I don't know essentially what a submissive guy wants, even though I am a submissive guy. And it reminded me how hard it is sometimes to know what the person you're with is really seeking. So in thinking about that, I came up with this, and we don't necessarily have to do this here, but I offer it to you to do on your own. But I wanted to just go through some of the stuff on it to see if it's helpful at all. And the reason is that these are all things that I'm trying to do myself. Because when I get online or when I meet people, I may have a lot of experience in the leather community, but I've been only working on my sobriety for 3 years, and it's all new to me again. So all the things that I had relied on, drugs allowing me to be a little pig during sex, I'm back to being terrified half the time. I'm back to not knowing what I should do. I'm 49, so that's 31 years since I actually started getting involved in kink. And I don't have the confidence I used to have. I sometimes just don't know what to do, and it's kind of funny. So there isn't a moment where you, quote, get this or figure it all out or suddenly become smooth operator or something like that. It is confusing in lots of different ways for the course of your life. And if you achieve new connections, there'll be a whole new level of confusion. You know, as I learn to be a dom, sometimes I want an 1-800 dom line while I'm having sex. What do I do now? Am I entertaining him? Is he turned on? You know, I have a comedy routine of tying someone up because it's so, like, where are my knots? Where are my ropes? Oh, my God, is this going to... Is this going to be, you know, hold? So I'm just going to go through this, and then I thought maybe we could just talk. This is something that you can kind of fill out later. But the idea is that I think that too often people can just kind of seek the next thing in front of them, and it doesn't quite add up. You know, you're hooking up with people, but it just doesn't feel like it's adding up to anything. And I truly believe that Leatherman have a unique sexuality in a few different ways. When the leather culture was very small, to be part of it, you had to kind of be an upstanding person. If you were someone who used other people or damaged them or hurt them, you were kind of, people knew about it. You know, you wouldn't continue to get laid. And in a way, it inculcated this really wonderful sense of values. And in a way, people began to really combine that with their sexuality, that it wasn't just a kind of sexuality, it was really a kind of set of values, and there was an honor code. And I'm not trying to, you know, have a fantasy idea of the 70s or anything like that, because people were just as scared and shitty and mean and selfish and all those things. I don't think there was a golden era, but I think that different social pressures elicited better things in people who were together. Now that people can be online and can change what their screen name is, they don't run into you because it's San Francisco or San Diego, and it's not that pedestrian city. I don't think there's as much social pressure to be nice to each other online, and I've seen some of the worst of it since I've been down here. So I think there's something that you can actually think of as intentional sexuality, which is, what are your intentions? What are they as you live your life sexually? And so these are just some things to think about. And these are things that I journal about, which is, the first is, what are your values? Because in the end, I think that's the measure of who you are. And I think leather values are very unique ones. And I think it's worth understanding what they are as part of this culture, because I think it's going to carry you through lonely times. It's going to carry you through difficult encounters. It's going to help you be a teacher yourself. It's going to help you spot the people that you want to be with if you really have a good sense of what your values are. So there's a place to kind of write some of that out. The other thing is, just like any salesperson wants to kind of understand the needs of their customers, they don't just demand that you buy their stuff. One of the things that I think is missing from the online discourse is what the other person might be looking for. Pretty much what I've heard from the encounters I've seen online is people telling me what they want me to do to them, especially now that I've got this old daddy thing going. They don't realize that for me a sling is just prosthetics to keep my legs up while I'm fucked. But so I read as daddy, and so there's a lot of bottoms who and submissives who reach out to me, and pretty much it's a laundry list of what they want to do to me, and very rarely are they good at being able to say what they want to offer. And so if it's worth your while, I would also fill out the next section, which is, think of the best ways that someone has ever treated you sexually, and think of the worst ways that someone has ever treated you sexually. And then turn that around and think of the best ways that you've ever treated someone sexually, and in your own privacy, think of the worst ways that you've ever treated someone sexually. And then finally, think about what you want to get from a sexual encounter, but the real square here, if there was an important one, if you really want to connect up, is try to start thinking about what the other person wants to get out of connecting with you sexually. Because I really guarantee you that if you think about what they really are seeking, it will make your connection much completely different. It will change the whole discourse. And I don't think it's really a top or bottom thing. I think it's just something that's missing a lot these days is, what is the person that you're going to connect with? What are they seeking? If you think about that first, you might actually get what you're seeking a lot more. The next pieces are just wants and needs to kind of have a good sense of what it is, which is, you know, what is the best sex you've ever had? What is the peak experience that you've either had or you fantasize about having? And then I think it's worth sometimes thinking about what's underlying that. Because it's easy sometimes to go down a dark road with your own fantasies if you don't understand what it is you really want. And I think a lot of times people get uncomfortable with their sexuality, and that's where, you know, the drugs ensue, because they don't have a good sense of what it is they're seeking. I think that, in addition, we live in a culture of people being really picky. I remember when Yahoo Groups came out. Do you remember Yahoo Groups? Okay. Okay. They're still around. And I remember the first time I saw a Yahoo group for black doms who wore sneakers in Oakland. And I thought, surely there's a subgroup based on what brand? And I thought, this is crazy, you know? What is someone really seeking? I've got a foot fetish, you know? Do we really get to that point of specificity? The other thing that I would just suggest, and what I journal about myself, is how do you get in your own way? What are the things that you do that sabotage connecting with other guys? We all do something. So it's worth sometimes to figure out what that is. And then along with that, if you know, there's always someone less experienced than you and more experienced than you. But to the person who's less experienced, what's the one piece of advice that you would give them? Because if it's something that you would give to someone else, it's probably one of the strongest, you know, guiding principles of your own. And the last two pieces are, think about what are the actions that you take that have the least results. If, you know, you're going online for 5 hours a week and you're getting laid twice a year, in business terms, you've got a really fucked up return on investment. But people still do it. And so the very last piece is thinking about something that you can do differently. We all get in our patterns, and I know it's really safe, for instance, to go online or to do something that feels comfortable. But if it's not working for you, I encourage you to try something just a little different. For me, it was starting to top. And believe me, I've got a lot more sympathy for all the tops that I tortured over the last 30 years as a bottom. Because I learned how often I thought I was being submissive and I was really being selfish. I thought that I was being, just bright and shiny enough that I didn't have to do any work on my part. And I really didn't appreciate all the work that those men who were my sirs were putting into taking care of me and often knowing myself better than I did. Often actually giving me what I needed when I couldn't even articulate it. So my pup teaches me a whole lot about being a submissive, and he's wonderful. And you know, I'm just as novice about trying to find a top now at the age of 49 as I ever was. So those are the things I was going to share. And if you have any questions, we can talk or anything you like.
All right. Bob, why don't you turn off the AC? All right, let me grab this real quick, if I may. What I'm going to do, let me share a little bit in return for your sharing. And okay. Thank you, by the way.
Sure.
Since you're kind of new to the crew, let me kind of give you the welcome message. How did you find out about the group in the first place?
How did I find out? I think I was talking to Lauren and Alex.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Nice. The reason why I asked is because... Let me give you a little history of our group, and I think it's illustrative of the point and gets back to you, I promise. This is like the welcome message that I love to give, but I normally don't take the time. A little over 3 years ago, I was anguished because I could tell that things weren't going well. I felt that we'd gone from no internet at all to too goddamn much of it. That we had lost opportunities to connect on a heart level, to be able to use our bullshit detectors, to use pheromones and hugs and intuition to be able to judge where somebody's being authentic, whether he's actually going to follow through. And the problem is that we've gone way too far. One of the common phrases I use is that too much internet makes us socially retarded. And I think we can all agree with that. And so then what I've been doing with the group... How did the group begin? I aggressively went face to face with thousands of strangers.
That's kind of a weird thing to do, but that's me. It's what I do. By going up to people and connecting with them one-on-one and engaging with them and saying, we're creating a group that is about building brotherhood. I remember back in the 70s, and I had a large amount of people who I could fall back on, that I could trust, and it is time to recreate that energy because there's a big gap. And people say, oh, okay, I'll give you my email address. I'm very persuasive. Well, then we started having a lot of events, and people learned that they could trust the events. So I'm going to do this in front of you. It's a standard rhetorical question, but show of hands, how many people here have ever been treated shabbily at any of our events? No hands. Oh, who raised their hand? Oh, well, yeah. Well, yeah, but that, yeah, but Bob, you're my slave. You're supposed to do that. That's your job. Very good. Very good answer. I like that. I'll be dealing with you later, boy. No, the point, again, is that people can trust the result. In the last 38 months, we've had somewhere around 500 fetish men, you know, endorsed events. And nothing goes wrong. They don't go suddenly veering off into the weeds. We don't have factions hissing and spitting at each other. We don't have people grabbing the steering wheel and steering it right into a brick wall. The reason why is because this is a heart-based group. This is a hug-based group. The intention behind this group is to start over, to ask the questions that you did towards the end of your talk, to say, wait a second, my assumptions, what about those? Am I really married to my assumptions? Can I start over? Can I maybe play with the concept of actually starting out as a child again and really trying to get past all that noise from my past and just starting from a position of innocence? The reason why, I know it kind of threw you off that there were so many tops in the room. Yeah, you're not used to that. But the reason why, what I assert, and you guys tell me if I'm wrong, I have made it my project to coach as many tops as possible. You're right now towards the tail end of about a 3 or 4 month arc of discussions that are all about how to be an effective top. The reason why this has been happening is that my experience is one of the biggest gaps we've got is people who ask the kind of questions you're asking. It's like, where do I call 1-800-NOM? Well, I can't be Mr. Perfection because I never was. But anything I have, I will gladly share. So we have this stuff recorded, a lot of it. But, you know, it's all online for you. Because the intention is by having what I call cocky tops, people who are confident, people who have some swagger because they like who they are, because they know that they've been signed off on different things on how to do flogging, how to be an ethical type of top, what the virtues and values are. We've had that discussion. We've had a lot of that kind of discussion. And the reason why we're doing it is because, as I said, one of the most tragic, tragic things that I reveal, and it's a nasty, nasty thing that I have to say. But there was a statistical study, you know, a while ago. I don't know, somewhere around 15 years ago. I wish I could find the citation that says, someone who wants to find an experienced, respected, high-quality sir and be a collared boy for him has a 4% chance of finding one. And that's not okay. I am committed to increasing the odds. And that's why I'm doing what I'm doing. That's why we have so many people who are having a bit more spring in their step and a little bit more swagger. Because they like who they are. They've proven that they have what it takes. And they're improving on a constant and ongoing basis. So that's the work that I'm doing. That's why I take the extra time to do a lot of one-on-one coaching. That's the reason why we do it here. This is the mass production version of that. This is crowdsourcing wisdom. See, it's not just me telling people this is the way to be. We're causing a conversation where people are sharing from their experience. And everybody is wearing an invisible T-shirt that says mentor on it. Everybody. We're not just talking down at people, we're all sharing. So that's what you normally, that's what you've been missing. So just be clear that we have a lot more of that whenever you want. And that's, you know, I'm just letting you know. I think we can all agree that the things that he has put on the sheets of paper that he's passed around, each one of those could be an entire two-hour session, couldn't they? And I think that they have that possibility. You might have to start rearranging your schedule. Because what we do is we do arcs. We do ARC, arcs, where we'll do a four-month session on, you know, what holds me back, or a four-month sequence of discussions on something else, whatever it is that needs to be talked about. Well, this obviously is a conversation that could be very powerful, and we could go as long as we want on it. And these are very deep and very proper questions. These are real questions. These are exactly what we deal with in this. The reason why we have these meetings every damn Wednesday, people in other cities say, every Wednesday? Well, I think you all know why we do it every Wednesday, because people would bitch at me if we didn't, because it's so much fun, and it's good, and it's useful, and it's nourishing to the soul. Because where else are we going to have substantive discussions? What you're bringing is substantive discussion. Clearly, you have a talent for it. And your insecurities that you mentioned, well, I think we all can say we all have about an equal amount, at least, of insecurities. I do. I know I do. And that's okay. That we're not looking for Mr. Perfection. The way that I'm always saying it is we don't need more stereotypical Tom of Finland cartoon character, you know, super doms. What we're looking for is men and leaders and subs and boys and sirs and masters and all the rest of that who come from kindness. Yes, there's a lot of people who like to be abused, but we can't do that 24/7. We have to have somebody who knows what virtues and values truly are. Otherwise, they're just sociopaths, in my opinion. And yes, I'm projecting, but that is my judgment, having been in the scene a long time. That we need to have some sense that the person we're dealing with is really ultimately looking out for our best interests. And clearly, your questions are coming from that direction. And I acknowledge you for that. And honestly, don't be too surprised if I'm now going to ask that everybody do their homework and fill out the form. And in 2 weeks, we'll meet back here, and we'll have that discussion in depth. We don't have to make it, you know, an 18-week sequence unless it turns out that that is what we need to do. We'll find out based on your responses. But my request is that you do the homework. I will. Because these are questions that need to be looked at. These have value. These have depth. They're the exact opposite of bar chatter. You know, who's fucking who, when's the next party? These are the sort of discussions that in order for us to be the kind of you know, tribe that we're supposed to be, we need to have these things. And my promise to you is that this is a very, very welcome thing, and clearly you're showing what your talents are. Well, good for you. Your thoughts.
These are just things I've been asking myself, so, you know, I've just been stumbling over this stuff, and I apologize that I can't come regularly, because this is the late day that I cover at work.
Mm-hmm. So. That's fine. You know, go ahead.
Quit.
Look at what you're missing.
Yeah, really. Well, if nothing else, we'll be recording it for you.
Yes.
Specifically, yes.
And let's not forget the switches.
There you go. Sing it out, honey.
The fanciest dancers around.
That's right. Switches are good. So other people who have thoughts, yes.
I just want to expand on what you had said earlier about we are so ingrained with the online society that me personally, I've completely lost any social skills in a public setting. I curl up into a fetal position internally when I go to the bar because I don't know how to approach people. This group has been an opening for me to rediscover who I am, to rediscover who I want to be, and to experiment. And it's getting me out from behind my computer, which I spend 5 or 6 hours on a day. And this is after work. Okay, this is once I get home, I'm chatting and watching TV. And I genuinely want to start over. I want to learn how to connect with people on a deeper level. I want to get that back, so I am not so dependent. I want to wean myself off of the online world because to me it's so fake. And I'm not fake. When I say I'm going to meet someone, I meet someone. I met someone this afternoon, as a matter of fact, before coming here. And I had to cut it short because I really enjoyed meeting them, but I wanted to get here. This is my group. I feel a part of something that I haven't felt a part of in a very long time, and it warms me.
Someone else? Yeah, just Marty and then you.
Tony and I go back many, many years.
Oh, yeah. And decades.
And one of the things, we used the country dance. We go to BJ's when it was here, and then Kickers. And that's how I met people. Because not only did you do the line dances, but you did the couple dances. Whether you held them stomach to stomach or back stomach to back. And that is one of the ways I got to meet people. And that got me out. I come into the leather bar, and I'm not the most sought-after guy. And, you know, but what I can do is I can go there, and then I come here, and I feel good. And then I remember, Tony, when there used to be a dance bar with Northwest? And anyway, he would be there with his sheet, and he says, "Hi, I'm Tony," and we'd be out there dancing until like 2 o'clock in the morning. Remember? Mm-hmm. On 30th Street. Mm-hmm. And that's how Tony and I became to know each other even more. And we would go there and we'd just have a good time. The Leathermen and the Leather Bar, I find, are different. I think, you know, I don't know if they stay to themselves, but if you can get somebody, I can't get people to come up to me at the Leather Bar, and I'm saying, well, maybe it's me. You know, I look at myself and I say, maybe
quick,
it's
quick show of hands, how many people relate to that? Keep going.
Right. Now, and I did that one night. We met here. And then we all went over to the Eagle, and there were people there. And I mean, I had a nice time. I don't drink, but I mean, or I had a Mick Ultra or something like that. I don't drink, but I mean, I was at the pool table. I was at the bar. And years ago, I used to go in there and I used to have fun, you know. But since I'm older, it's different. But I mean, I want to meet somebody. You know, I don't care how old they are or how young they are. I just want to be able to communicate back and forth with someone. I don't find that happening on the computer. I mean, it's probably, you know, when I get on the computer and I'm on Zeus, I'm getting people from Palm Springs. I'm getting people from L.A. I'd rather meet someone here in San Diego. That's my problem. And these people are so shallow, you know, all they want is to meet you just to go to bed with you. And that's the problem I'm having, being an older, mature person. There's a big difference in being someone that's in their 40s and 50s.
People who are in their 40s and 50s and 60s have a history of belonging to traditional style affinity groups also, where we're used to newsletters, where we're used to, you know, meetings and bylaws and rules of order and all that other stuff. A lot of people, not everybody. And those sort of institutions have died. That's why Fetishman doesn't have bylaws. That's why we don't charge for anything. We don't have a bank account. That's why we don't make people jump through hoops or wear uniforms. The reason why is because we live in a highly distractible age. And if somebody doesn't like what's going on, they just click on a different link and they're gone. Piff. So we have to provide what it is that people are actually looking for that the internet cannot and never will provide, which is connectedness, relatedness, authenticity. Scary to people who can't do it, but the people who hunger for it, it's pretty damn nice. Yes, please.
I got a question, and maybe it's just me, but if you think about it, outside of the bar, outside of being online, what are the healthy ways to places and situations where you could meet other single gay men. If you're straight, there's tons of things that you can do. Tons of places you can go. You can go to church. You can go to singles groups. You can go to this. You can go to that. There's tons of it. But where does a gay man go to meet people? Just to meet people and connect. The only places that I know of are the bar.
I'd say that all that stuff exists for gays too. You just kind of got to seek it out a little bit. But all those things, all those activities exist for us. Any sport you want to play, there's gay sports for that. There's churches, you know, more traditional and more modern churches here in San Diego. You know, just up the street, there's multiple churches you can go to.
Yeah.
There are you know, like the speed dating. There's different little groups for everything here. You just you know, you can't use the internet for good. So you can use the internet to research.
You can also use the front desk at the center, because they're connected like crazy to all of that. You watch the Pride Parade, all the hours and hours and hours that watch all the contingents go by, but you're going to see stuff you had no idea existed. There is a lot of resources out there. The problem is it's really hard for the people who organize those to find the perfect demographic to get on the list, because the problem, I mean, yes, there's many very good things about the internet, and we could talk about that for quite a long time. But one of the bad things about the internet, it has vaporized us as a community, in that if someone is on Adam for Adam and their ideal life partner is over on, you know, Daddy Hunt, the two don't really connect with each other. And you're not going to ever connect between each other unless you're actively out there, you know, on every possible resource. You got the bareback RT, you got the, you know, the Manhunt, you got the Adam for Adam, you got all the rest of that stuff. It's hard to find each other. And what a big problem, as I've always said, is that we don't have dependable information coming in about social opportunities. The reason why I've been doing the newsletter for 166 weeks minus one is because I'm filling a gap that used to be filled all the time by the gay rags, because everybody read them, and by the bars, because everybody went to them. You know, it would be no problem. San Diego had, I think, 6 leather-ish type bars running simultaneously around 1980. We don't have that nowadays. We don't hang out in the bars and share idea virus type memes saying, oh, did you know about this new thing coming up? Ooh, how do I find out more? We don't do that anymore. Now it's basically every man for himself. The reason why I go up to people and I'm a big old creep, I come up and say, here's some pictures from our events. Would you like to be on my email list? Well, you know, in the early days, it was very creepy. People weren't sure what kind of drugs I was trying to sell them. Well, now, I don't even have to do it anymore, because now we get, honestly, between 5 and 6 new members a day. Every day. Day in, day out. They're coming to us. The reason why is because we're providing exactly what we promise. And word is getting out, and people are telling their social circles. So let's hear it. What do you want to say? Come on.
Thank you very much for your talk. And for presenting this, and this is really good. This is like it's a roadmap, and like Tony said, the conversation has already started. And with you coming here, it's good to sometimes have something in writing and to put it in writing. And I will take a look at this. I'm already on this path. These questions that you asked, I'm already on that path. And what I want to offer is that not only is there gay stuff to do, camera, sports, and all that. For myself, I had to take a journey and look within inside myself. You know, I'm 52 years old, and you talked about recovery, and I'm a recovery man, and, you know, I'm active in 12-step. And that's a good launch pad for me to start to take a look at myself and see who am I. And other things that I've done that really I got some great benefit out of it is an organization called Body Electric. And it's all about men getting in touch with, I mean, it really blew my, it turned my life inside out for me to get in touch with what am I about sexually? What turns me on? It enabled me to take a look at that in situations I didn't know what to ask for. And so I really want to encourage you, you know, people, you know, that's what I did. I did Body Electric, and they have all kind of courses. They even have a SM course that I've done it, and I've assisted with it twice. It's up in L.A., and it happens every other year, and it's happening this year up in L.A. And another organization that I'm affiliated with is called the Mankind Project of San Diego.
How would you spell that?
It's together, M-A-N-K-I-N-D, and it's called MKP.org. And what they put on is called the New Warrior Training Adventure, and it's for all men to get in touch with their sacred masculinity, about how they show up as men. And it's really big, and Tony's been talking about it, accountability, integrity, being a force in your community, and that really has, that also changed my life and to how I show up, because being a gay man and being a black gay man, when I was growing up, I didn't trust men. You know, men was always out to conquer and devour me. And with doing that New Warrior Training Adventure really turned my life around. And I could, if anybody have questions, I can bring some information with that at a later date. I'm going to have to leave because my partner is at the ER, and I'm going to have to go and check on him to see what's going on.
So before, go ahead.
Yeah, but Papa, thank you very much, and thank you for bringing this up.
My request is that as time goes by, would you please make sure that we get in connection with these things, say have someone come in as a guest speaker? We'll do that. Yeah, because they'll find a very receptive group of people listening. Okay, let me do him and then you. Okay?
I was going to add to what he said. When I was a little bit younger and I was really frustrated, I couldn't connect with people. And I was kind of like on the same boat, and my mentor at that time told me to find the things that I like and start going and doing those things, because there is where I was going to connect with the people. I paint. I'm a hairdresser. I started doing things I joined a gym. I didn't look like this before. I was heavier. And that helped me with my self-confidence. Like when they're talking about insecure, well, we all are. That's just life, but we start developing, and then we attract the people that we're becoming. And like, I am also a member of the Mankind Project that Magnum talked about, and it really is a great organization for men to get in touch with themselves. And it will change everything. You learn so much about projection, what we project, and why we don't get what we want is because that's what we are creating up in our heads.
Mm-hmm. And I make the same request of you. Would you make sure that we get more connected with the Mankind Project?
Absolutely.
Please, because like I said, I mean, we're pretty much ripe, low-hanging fruit for groups like that.
It changed my life. Like, one of the topics is what do you know about sex? Mm-hmm. And so you get to learn about what is your story. And, like, I mean, it's a great weekend, the new Warrior Training Adventure. It's a great, great program.
Wonderful. Thank you. All right. Please.
I appreciate your talk. A couple weeks ago, we were talking about, bottoms and tops and like we always talk about. Anyway, and Magnum had some suggestions and things about how to treat somebody that was going to be your bottom. And a couple days later, I met this guy online. And it was on Adam for Adam. And I've never met anybody quite like him. I've never met a bottom more. I don't know how I describe a professional bottom. Somebody who is so meticulous and knew exactly what the fuck he was doing, that it made me feel like I knew what I was doing. Hmm. And then I took what I'd learned from, from you guys, you know, because, I mean, it's all stuff that we've discussed before. But the crux of it was I learned from Magnum. It was like the day after, or the day after that, that Magnum was talking about, talking about this stuff. And I had this interaction with this man, and it was probably one of the best sexual experiences of my life. you know, because it was, I don't know, it was just, it was a very, very, very good experience. And I don't think that I would have that good of an experience without coming to a meeting like this, because I just, like I've told you before, I just, when I first met Tony, we talked a lot, like the first couple weeks. I felt really lost after being in a relationship for like almost 11 years. And you fuck the same way every fucking time you have sex, you know. He wanted to do it in the shower every fucking time. And even though I try to get him to do something different. So anyway, you get kind of locked into that. And then when you don't have that person anymore, you're like, kind of like this. Anyway, I could just talk about that shit all night. But anyway, it was a great experience. And I think it was a great experience because of some stuff that I learned from here. Because I wouldn't have known that stuff. I automatically knew what to do as soon as he came in the house. I kind of like checked him out. He was smaller than me, which I like. I don't like him taller. And I just sort of sized him up. I turned him around like I was, you know, looking at a horse in an auction or something. and just like Magnum said to do. And then it made him feel like he was important. And then I spun him around and was checking him out. And then I took all his clothes off one thing at a time. It was sexy.
Nice. I rejoice with you. Let's hear it for successes. Yay. Yes, Marty.
I just want to say there's on the web, there's a thing called Meetup, different groups. Just go in, put gay groups, San Diego, and see what they have. Because they have all different types of groups.
You say salon.com?
Yes.
Really? I didn't expect that.
You mentioned the center, and I think it's such a great resource that we have here. You guys have never been there. You literally can walk in there and ask them anything, and they'll have a resource for you. But the other thing about the center that's great is it's a great place to go and find a group to volunteer for. And besides just joining groups because you want to meet people, volunteering, I found, is just, besides being rewarding, you wouldn't believe that, you know, you meet quality people. You meet people that have a common interest. That's been the most surprising thing about volunteering for various causes, that you meet some amazing people. And if you're looking for quality people, you know, find a group and volunteer and do some good in the process.
What you just said, I'd like to expand upon it, and thank you. It's a very, very important point. Speaking as somebody who has not been president or organizer or founder of a group in the last 30-something years, you know, I'm always in charge of something. It's just my nature. You know, I join a group, and within about a week, I'm on the board, and in 2 weeks, and they've, you know, put me in front. That's not a brag. It's just who I am. But the thing that I've noticed, being the guy who is what I call the capital S source, where everybody, you know, when you say, who's in charge here, and everybody pivots around and points at me, you know, that's the position I put myself in. It has drawbacks, which is that when everybody needs, I need this, I need that, then it just becomes natural to sort of tune it out. It's what your brain does. It just becomes background noise. Can't help it. It's how we're evolved. But every once in a while, somebody will come up to me and say, what can I do to help? At that point, my head snaps around. I go, oh, there's one. Because that person suddenly impresses the hell out of me, because almost nobody says, how can I help? Except in this group. Everybody does. But what I'm saying is that in a traditional, typical affinity group, when somebody says, I want to help, it means that they are what I call part of the golden core. The golden core is the 10% of the group that makes 90% of the difference. They're the ones that cause the leader of a group to show up every time, because they are the wind beneath our wings. Because those are the people who have big hearts, and they're coming from kindness, and they're coming because they can't not be that generous person. As a community leader, my job is to notice, to continuously pay attention, and to thank them. Because somebody who volunteers is not necessarily doing it for a thank you, but they're sure as hell not doing it for a fuck you. And being disrespected is going to break their hearts, and they're going to walk away. The person who's trapped at the volunteer table keeping an eye on the silent auction items for 4.5 hours without a pee break because everybody forgot that they existed is not going to volunteer next time. So we have to make sure that they get the kind of nourishment that they need. Not just thank you, thank you, thank you, but making sure that they are getting all the pieces that they need to want to keep going. Not to work them like a dray horse until they fall dead, you know, in front of the plow, but because the people who are kind, who are coming from generosity, deserve to have doors open to them that they didn't even know exist, which is what you're talking about. Because people who volunteer, who stand shoulder to shoulder to make sure that that dream, that big, powerful thing that's coming up comes true, they have a special bond. And suddenly, social circles start overlapping like crazy. Think of a Venn diagram where you've got two circles and they overlap slightly and the part in the middle is what matters. Well, what matters is the fact that, say, somebody who's real active with, let's say, you know, the local football team or something like that, well, he also knows some great guys in the Kinky crew. And say, you know, there's somebody I'd like you to meet. You know, he's just as nice as you are. And doors open. And social circumstances improve for everybody involved because you've proven that you're worth it. We don't refer flakes. The people that we introduce to our most favorite people are people who have proven that they have what it takes to sustain a true relationship. And that's always been true in the kink community back when we were at our very best. I think you can say that there were people that you knew you could depend upon. Absolutely. That's part of our past. That's part of our future, and that's what this group is about. So thank you for making that point. That's editorial number 34B.
If I can, I'd like to expand on both concepts back on the center. I mean, everyone in here, if we have not talked to anybody at the center, you don't have a contact there, if you haven't randomly just walked in there and talked to the front desk about, hey, where can I go get tested for genital warts or whatever, if you haven't walked in there and made any kind of contact, I honestly think you're cutting yourself short because the center is it's a give and take. I volunteered with them. I've worked with them. I've met people. I mean, I go to their HIV support group. They are the best. And I think all around us, altogether, whether it's the leather and fetish community, whether it's whatever it is that you're doing in life, it requires community. So you need to be able to commune with other people who relate to you. And I think being in San Diego, we're fortunate enough to have the center. I think we need to utilize it. And we should utilize it. And I think we owe it to them to utilize it. I mean, go in there and just say, hey, what's up? And I promise you, you're not going to walk out of there without finding something to do. I think that was kind of just my whole point. I'm done.
Very good. Thank you. All right. Hang on.
I just wanted to ask if we have a presence at the center, would they be able to find out about FMSD people?
That's a good question. I've been assuming that they do. But would you take on finding out? Yeah. And if not, then would you make sure that they get that? I'm a really great guy, but I'm forgetful. I just realized after about 4 months that my business website was not populated with actual information because they moved it for me. And I've been wondering why it's been very quiet business-wise lately. Yes.
One of the funnest evenings you could have, go to the center, first Wednesday of the month, game and grub night. There's about 150 guys there. They feed you. They have lousy pizza.
Good night, honey.
Or they have a good sandwich. You know, and you just meet people. And don't sit with the people you came with. Go and sit with different people and meet them.
Yeah. Even if they're not like you, even if they're not somebody you expect to ever have sexual intercourse up to and including orgasm, invest in getting to know them. It's a wonderful process. Absolutely. Thank you, Marty. That's wonderful. So tell you what. Yeah, go ahead.
Yep. One other thing that I wanted to mention is, you know, we've talked a lot about how we go out and meet people in San Diego. And for me, being part of the, I really consider myself a little bit more fetish-oriented than leather-oriented, although I probably have as much leather as anybody in here.
We'll have to have that conversation.
Maybe not you.
Yeah.
Maybe not you. I could fill a retail store with all the stuff I've got. But what's very interesting is I tend to be very conservative as a person overall and career-wise, and I have had a really difficult time, you know, walking into a leather bar. You know, I have a tendency to just say, I'm just going to go to this meeting tonight with what I've got on. I didn't have time to go home. So what I have found really interesting is that I've been really quiet with my friends about being into fetish and being into leather stuff. And the really interesting thing I found is I've known Amin and Gary for years, and we were at a pool party a couple months ago. It was like 2 days before I came to the first one of these meetings, and they start talking a little bit about leather and about this meeting and everything, and I'm like, what the hell? I've known these guys for years, and I had no idea that we had something in common like this. And that is one of the cool things about a group like this, because I'm meeting not only new people like Tommy and Stuart and you, but I'm also seeing people that I've already known for years that I just didn't have any idea that had some interest in fetish or leather stuff. And that's why I think this group has been really phenomenal for me in the short time that I've been here.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That's wonderful. So tell you what, let's wind it up. We're kind of running a little bit past time, and this is a conversation that clearly can go on. So let's have it go on 2 weeks from now. Okay,
Next week, you keep saying 2 weeks or 7 weeks. What's next week?
This next week is Forbidden Orgasms. If you'd read your newsletter, you would know that.